project. We've invested resources the legislature's given us in compliance to meet additional revenue commitments over the last 6 years of about $70 million. And I'm thinking we're going to look at about another $40 million this coming biennium if the budget, the governor's recommended budget policy option packages and some tax compliance work that the revenue committees have been working on are approved. We have used automation and technology to achieve a lot of savings in processing of tax returns and tax payments. About 85% of your income tax revenue comes in through people making their payments on time and correctly. This processing season, we will see more than 50% of the returns coming in electronically, which saves a lot of money and is much more accurate for taxpayers. And in April, we had our first $1 billion deposit month, which indicates we're putting more money in the bank faster for use by state government in delivering services. We've turned back positions every biennium through efficiencies and asked the legislature whether you wanted to reinvest those resources in additional productivity or use the resources elsewhere. We have developed an integrated business and technology plan that to achieve our goals and carry out our responsibilities. Looking back to sort of the beginning of my time, we still were implementing Measure 50, which dramatically changed the property tax system, and also worked on a significant change in the taxation of forest land. I'd like to continue the position for a couple of reasons. One, this is a really exciting time to be in state government. We are trying in the executive branch to integrate better services to citizens and businesses. We're trying to take an enterprise approach to government and really doing a lot more effective partnership across agencies as we work with stakeholder groups. Technology and use of the internet is getting to be more and more an important part of the work that we do, the tools that we use for the work we do every day. And I've had the honor not only to serve as the director of the department and serve in a leadership role here in state government, but also to serve in a leadership role nationally as a member of the Multi-State Tax Commission. Looking forward, more use for technology, more efficiency for the organization.
Thank you.
We have some new challenges on the horizon in achieving compliance and making sure that the revenue that is due under the laws that exist today comes in. We are finding opportunities to work with other states to be very exciting, share information, resources, and training with other states that are facing the same kinds of issues. We're going to be undertaking some work in the next interim with the county assessors to look at the property tax system and try to figure out what that needs to look like now in the 21st century and in this post-Measure 50 era. So there's just a lot of good stuff going on, and I'd like to stay involved in it.
Great. And when you talked about tax compliance, I assume you were referring to Senate Bill 480, which I believe has passed this chamber, and I think hopefully going to be moving forward on the House side.
Yes, Senator is referring to Senate Bill 480. That has a number of compliance components in it, as well as some policy option packages that are included in our budget.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Harshenko? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for your good work in this area.
I had
a specific question on something you mentioned, and that is we made dramatic changes in the way we tax forest land.
Mm-hmm.
Have we reduced the amount of revenue we receive from forest land because of those changes?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, what's happened is the way in which it's collected has been shifted between state government and local government. Before Measure 50, the taxes on forest land were collected through a severance tax system so that property owners paid property tax only on 20% of the value of their forest land, and the other taxes that would typically have been paid as a property tax on a year-by-year basis were deferred until trees were harvested. And then when the cash flow came from the harvest, there was a severance tax that was basically in lieu of that property tax. It was assessed by the department, collected by the department, and then distributed back to the counties where the timber was harvested. After Measure 50, mostly the industrial property owners who had very large tracts of forest land wanted to have the same kind of protections as Measure 50 offered for all other property owners, for forest land owners as well. And Governor Kitzhaber asked me to put some working groups together to look at how that transition might occur. It took place over 3 legislative sessions, getting the pieces in place. But now, forest land can be taxed either at 100% of its value. It's an election process now. 100% of its value every year, property tax paid, all paid directly to the county, not collected by the department. And then there's an option for those landowners who have fairly small parcels. They can elect to use a system very similar to the old system, where they pay a portion on a portion of their value, and then when they harvest, they make a payment based upon the harvest. So the big change was for most of the privately held land that's in very, very large tracts, the taxation valuation is still done centrally, but the taxation and the collection of the taxes is now happening at the county level instead of through the department and then distributed back.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Did these changes result in less revenue?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that the expectation was that there would be less revenue. Part of that was due to the fluctuation in the value of timber. But part of it was due to the fact that with we did a major valuation study of all of the categories of forest land in the state. Again, Department of Revenue working with private sector and some private appraisers to set the new base of value that would then slide in consistently with the way that values were affected by Measure 50. So the value base was reduced, and so there was a reduction in the amount of tax paid overall, and then there was also the split. Most of those dollars now are collected directly by the county, and we manage only the small owner program where there's an election made to continue to pay a tax when the forest lands are timbers cut.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else, Senator Ringo? I think that does it. We'll close the public hearing. Your appointment. We're generally waiting about a week before we move forward into work session on appointments. So.
All right.
Thank you. We really appreciate your willingness to serve the state.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on the Director of Department of Revenue. I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 1074. Senator Przanski and your folks, why don't you come on forward. Good afternoon. Senator Przanski, you're probably aware most of the members are up in the event upstairs. So.
What event upstairs?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and Senator Ringo, and committee staff. My name is Floyd Przanski, Senator, Senate District 4. Senate Bill 1074 is a pretty straightforward bill that would basically prohibit the city of Cobourg from receiving any revenues from traffic citations that are issued on Interstate 5 over a one-year period. The bill is set up in such a way that the bill would go into effect on July 1 of this year, and on July 1 of next year, 2006, the bill calls for the allowing of the city of Cobourg to be able to receive up to, but not exceeding, 10% of the city's annual budget in revenue from enforcement actions on Interstate 5 as it pertains to traffic violations. The reason for this bill is pretty straightforward from my perspective. This body 2 years ago during the last session actually attempted to send a message to the city of Cobourg as to their conduct, as to how they were utilizing the traffic enforcement on Interstate 5 for revenue raising. What we know from that perspective is that the time that the bill went through, there had been some acknowledgement through different law enforcement personnel, as well as other individuals who had the unfortunate encounter with officers from the city of Cobourg that they were receiving citations for traffic violations, for the most part speeding, that those tickets were being routed into their municipal court, and at the time the city of Cobourg had no jurisdiction over the interstate highway system in or near their city. What has happened since that time, this practice has continued. I've provided the committee with the editorial that came from the Oregonian dated December 24th, 2004. There's also is the OregonLive.com version of the article that ran in the Oregonian on December 19th of the same year. That article goes into great detail. The reporter for that paper, Brian Denson, went through and reviewed records of the city, the Springfield Justice Court, and basically was able to put together what type of activity and practice that was being used by the city of Cobourg. The important part of this is that as a city prosecutor for the city of Florence, and for my previous about 17, 18 years of doing work as a prosecutor for multiple jurisdictions, including Lane County District Attorney's Office, it's always been my belief that whenever you have rules and laws in place, that everyone needs to be abiding by them. The change that we made in the 2003 legislature was actually just a clarification of the existing statutes that made it very clear that a municipal court did not have jurisdiction over activity that did not occur within their jurisdiction, within their city limits, unless there was one provision prior to the change in 2003 that did allow for it to be the court that it could be referred to if a citation occurred outside of the county of where that municipal court resided, and it was the closest court to the offense.
Senator Brzezinski, could you just sort of state that in English, please?
All right. Basically, if on Interstate 5, prior to the change in 2003, mm-hmm. if an officer was citing someone in Linn County, right at the boundary line mm-hmm. of Linn and Lane County, they would be able to, under the old law, to cite that individual into the Cobourg Municipal Court within compliance with state law, because there was a rule that had been adopted by this body for convenience of the individuals, such as on the Marion County, Deschutes County, on the Cascades, where they could actually be cited into the Sisters Municipal Court instead of requiring them to go either all the way back to one of the circuit courts. So we basically sent the message and said that we wanted them to basically stop what they were doing. Instead of what they did is they increased their saturation on Interstate 5 while they were still not legally able to do so because they were in violation of the existing law. They thought that they didn't have to comply with the new law until January of 04. And if you look at I'll spare you the details that are within the Denson article, but it makes it very clear that they were in a position of bringing in hundreds of thousands of dollars into their court, and in my opinion, or through their court, illegally. What I've learned since then, and what I've actually seen on my own, is that even after they had this annexation, the annexation took in a very small portion of Interstate 5, that their officers have continued to be setting up and doing enforcement action outside of that jurisdiction. There's nothing to stop them from doing that, but when they take action outside of the jurisdiction, they're prohibited from putting it into their own court. The reason they put it into their own court is because they get 50% of the revenue that goes through the court, plus they get the 50% that's assigned to the governmental entity that the officer, he or she, is employed by. So basically they're doubling their return. And I've checked with numerous members of this body and asking them where they have seen city police being stationed and enforcing, and they're seeing the same thing I am. The other concern that I have is I've had a number of individuals who have contacted me that have received citations where we have talked about where that citation was issued in the sense of where they saw the officer located, and it was definitely outside of the city limits. That's on I-5. And further, that they had their cruise control set and they were being ticketed from anywhere from 4 to 8 miles over what they actually were set their cruise control. The reason I bring this to your attention is because as long as I've been involved as a prosecutor, I know that there's always going to be a difference of opinion as to what the actual speed was. But when you get as many complaints that I have received where people said, yes, I was doing 74 or 76, but I got a ticket for 81 or 82, it makes me wonder exactly what is actually going on there. So my problem is twofold. Number one, they've continued, and they actually did continue, even after they were received part of the jurisdiction over I-5, to utilize different areas and site illegally into their own court. And also, I believe, based on the test, based on the statements I have received from numerous individuals, that the actual alleged speed is not the correct speed that they were actually doing. What I also have done is, and some of the people that are giving the complaints, and based on where they said they saw the officer set up, and I can go in greater detail if you have questions, is that they are actually putting on the ticket that it's within their jurisdiction, milepost 199, when in fact the officer was not in place close to 199, but outside of that area. This bill is basically to finally get the message across. We've had a similar problem before any of us served in Jordan Valley, where we had a speed trap that had to be dealt with through the legislature. I'm asking this committee to send a message, a strong message, that we're going to prohibit them from realizing revenue off of this stretch of road, because they've been doing it, in my opinion, illegally for some period of time, and I think that it really flies in the face of public safety. And what I'd like to do is allow Dan Swift, who's with the Oregon State Troopers Association, give his testimony, then I will make a closing if necessary.
All right. Senator Prusansky, why don't you go ahead and then I'll ask Senator Prusansky questions.
Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, good afternoon. My name is Daniel Swift, and I am the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The OSPOA represents the sworn state troopers, forensic scientists, and dispatchers employed by the Department of State Police. And I do want to make it very clear I am here on behalf of this bill representing the troopers of the department, not the Department of State Police itself. I don't know if it even has an opinion on this bill. This is the troopers, though. First of all, I would like to state for the record is my opinion of myself as well as the vast majority of my members that it's bad public policy to have any governmental or political entity receive a direct monetary benefit from the enforcement action of that entity.
Sure?
It is my opinion that law enforcement and the justice system should never be used or perceived as being a substitute for a direct source of revenue to fund necessary governmental operations. The reason for this is obvious. In this country, we rely upon the voluntary cooperation of the citizenry to enforce and obey our laws and make the justice system work. The citizens support, trust, and obey the rulings of the courts, regardless of personal opinion, because by and large they believe the justice system is fair. However, when the citizenry reaches a conclusion that the government or the justice system is biased or not fair, then they will no longer support that system, and it then fails to function. The history of the United States is filled with examples of the citizenry, through simple civil disobedience, causing local and sometimes state governments to disintegrate because the people decided that the fix was in, the system was corrupt, and they had no moral obligation to support an unjust government. And they would not support it. As a professional law enforcement officer, I know more than most people how extremely important it is that the public have faith and trust in their police force and the court system. Because the minute the majority of the public loses that trust, then we have anarchy. And I believe that by allowing local governments to receive direct monetary compensation from their enforcement activity, Oregon has started down a slippery slope to losing the public's trust in their justice system. Once a city council or county commission perceives their local court as a source of operational revenue rather than a source of justice, then the overriding concern becomes the financial bottom line rather than fairness. One of the other dangers inherent in such a policy is it's subject to abuse, which brings us to the current bill, Senate Bill 1074. I don't think there's anyone who can look at what the city of Cobourg has been doing on Interstate 5 for the past few years and not draw a reasonable conclusion that they have been abusing the privilege this state has granted to local governments. And make no mistake, what the legislature has done is to grant a privilege. Using and corrupting the majesty and authority of the criminal justice system to enhance city coffers is nothing less than a policing the motoring public and legalized robbery. And it is not as though the city has not been warned. Last session, this legislature sent a very strong message to Cobourg that it was abusing the privilege the legislature had granted to all local governments. Rather than see the error of their ways, they instead looked for and found a way to circumvent the legislature's last correction and go back to doing what they were doing.
members of this committee, this legislature, needs to send a very strong and clear message, not just to Coburg, but to all local governments, that if you abuse the privilege the legislature has granted, then that privilege will be taken away. As a law enforcement officer dedicated to the criminal justice system, I am asking this committee to approve this bill on behalf of all of us in the criminal justice system. If this message isn't sent now, then sooner or later some other local government will do the same thing. And eventually the public faith in their justice system will disappear. Thank you.
Questions from the panel? For the testimony?
Thank you for coming and testifying today.
Yeah. If I could just put on the record, one thing I want to make a change, note that there was a change in Senate Bill 1074. It was originally drafted in another bill, and it had a prohibition of receiving any type of revenue for a two-year period. Based on the conversations that I've had with the officials from the city of Coburg, as well as from the testimony they provided, I decided to reduce that from a two-year prohibition to a one-year prohibition. I understand from the last testimony they gave on the previous bill, they took the position that they had learned their lesson, they were not doing this any longer, that they were basically still needing to pay off a $300,000 debt, and they were in fact going to continue to look at revenue off I-5 to help make ends meet. I made a commitment to the acting city manager that this bill would not go into effect until July 1 of this year to give them opportunity to get their accounting in order and to allow them to make a transition that's reasonable. I'm now asking this committee to follow through on what we have asked for and make certain that they will understand that the importance of living up to the privilege that they have and making sure that they are not allowing, I guess what I would call, the influence of a need for raising money to impact the decisions that officers make on a daily basis when they're in contact with citizens.
Chair, that's a question. The there are other jurisdictions that use revenue from the court system to defray court operations, court security, et cetera. And I'm certain that as a prosecutor, senator, you're well aware of that practice. How does this differ?
If I could, Vice Chair Farioli and committee members. What we did is we actually worked with the League of Cities, and they actually provided me with a survey that they did of their cities to see what was the, quote-unquote, a percentage of revenue that they used from their traffic enforcement into their annual budgets. Mm-hmm. Clearly, this city is above and beyond all. For the most part, it's somewhere between 2% and maybe up to 8%, 9% for most cities. There are a few that were on the list that they provided to me that were just over 10%, and I believe two were just at 15 or 16%. This city has been bringing in up to 48% of their revenue to operate their city budget off of this interstate system. And they have backed off from what they said, but it's down to like maybe 30%. And based on what I consider the legalities of using their court system when state law prohibited it, we have to stop this for at least a 12-month period to get this message across to them that enough is enough.
Thank you. Further questions from the panel? Thank you. And I'd like
Thank
to
you.
Call Senator Morsett forward if you'd like to offer testimony. You'd like to follow the panel? Okay. I'd like to call forward the Honorable Judy Volta, Mayor of Coburg, Mr. Landrum, who is the Finance Manager of the City of Coburg, and Acting Chief of Police John Bosley. And I'll just impanel those three, and we'll call up Mr. Schessler and Senator Morsett for cleanup. Thank you. Welcome, ma'am.
Thank you. And I'm Judy Volta, Mayor of Coburg, and these are some of our people that have joined us. Vice Chair Farioli and committee, I appreciate this coming. We were here about a month ago and spoke against the prior bill, the other bill that's also Senator Brzezinski submitted to the Judiciary Committee, and we're here with the same message in the same discussion. I became mayor about a little over a year ago. Coburg is a city of 969. We have had turbulent times. We now have taken very strong and active steps on changing our focus. prior years, we were too dependent on fines and bails as revenue. This was not done by myself or by other people here sitting before you, but we are taking steps. We have, in the past year, we have dismissed the city recorder, entered into a separation agreement with the prior city administrator police chief, laid off over 5 full-time employees, cut $300,000 from our budget. We have a strong city council. We have hired a new finance director, formerly of the state of Oregon, as a budget analyst. We have taken strong steps in financial oversight. We are on our way to doing the things that we need to do as a city. This Senate bill would cripple us as a city. We feel that it's mean-spirited. We feel that it focuses attention on us as a city when we're trying to do things right. I personally have gotten 2 tickets, speeding tickets on I-5, once cited by Eugene Police, once cited by Oregon State Police. Each time I was guilty as charged and paid the fine and did not take any kind of punitive measure against those who cited me. I have looked through the tickets. I have seen tickets in excess of 80, 90, 95, some up to 100 miles an hour. We are taking pains, again, to have it just be one of many things that we do as a city. But I would just ask the patience of this committee to work with us and not to focus attention. There have been some things that have been said about Coburg in the past that perhaps are true, but it's a new day in Coburg. We're doing our best. And I would ask that this bill not go forward. And I would turn it over to our chief of police, John Bosley. Thank you.
Vice Chair, Mayor Olley, committee members. My name is John Bosley, and I'm the acting police chief for the city of Coburg. I've been in that capacity I've been a police officer for Coburg for about 6 years. I've been in this capacity as acting chief for about the last 6 months. In that 6 years, I've seen a lot of positive things happen with Coburg, and I've seen the negative. It's no secret that late last year, Coburg found itself in a budget crisis. At best, this can be contributed to mismanagement by our former leaders that are no longer there. Since the discovery of that crisis, there have been drastic steps taken, as the mayor alluded to correct it. Along with the very dedicated mayor and council, the employees that have remained are determined that the city gets back to living within its means. It has been the belief by many, including myself at times, that the city of Coburg had an over-reliance on funds generated by traffic fines. Unfortunately, I was in a position at that time to where I couldn't do much about that. Some of these fines originate from violations that have occurred on a section of Interstate Highway 5 that is within the city limits of Coburg. And before I go any further, I'd like to speak on behalf of the officers that have remained with us. As with any officer anywhere, we practice the utmost in discretion in the issuance of a traffic citation. There are far more warnings issued than citations. The citations that are issued for speeding violations are in excess of 80 miles per hour. Kara McCowan, a reporter with the Register Guard, came in. We let her view every citation that's been issued on I-5. She did find one citation that was issued for 79 miles per hour. Just this last Saturday night, I clocked a vehicle northbound through the city of Coburg at 118 miles per hour.
Well, it wasn't me.
at this point, I relayed the information to the Oregon State Police due to the simple fact that I wasn't going to be able to catch him. I don't know if he ever got caught. Speeding violations are not the only situations we deal with. We've dealt with road rage incidences along with the Oregon State Police side by side. In the last 3 years, there have literally been hundreds of drunk drivers taken off this stretch from roadway by our department. And these aren't only dangerous to people that happen to be in the Coburg area. It's dangerous to anybody in the state, anywhere. Officers from the Coburg Police Department have received numerous awards from the Oregon Department of Transportation for the dedication to traffic safety. In 2004, the Coburg Police Department was chosen by the Governor's Advisory Council on DUII as the DUII Municipal Agency of the Year for its proactive enforcement of the state's DUI laws. One of my first priorities upon being asked to fill the role of acting chief was to significantly reduce the city's over-reliance on funds generated by traffic fines. And we've made great strides in that area. As Senator Posansky stated, he stated 48%. I actually think that number is probably higher. At this time, in the fiscal year 05-06 budget, that number is right now at 25%. It's still a number that I'm looking to reduce. And again, this is an effort to make Coburg live within its means. And not, as the police chief, I don't want the city of Coburg balancing its budget on my back. The reductions in the police department since the discovery of this budget crisis have been drastic. When I took the position, I found myself having to lay off fellow police officers, many of whom I started this career with. We've reduced the number of police officers from 8 to 5. I've liquidated police vehicles, police equipment. I've eliminated all overtime for officers. Employees took a 6% pay decrease. They have started contributing heavily to their own benefits, but they remain. In addition to these immediate reductions upon the discovery of this budget crisis, the overall police department budget has been reduced 49% from that in fiscal year 04-05. At this point, the police department is just struggling to provide 24-hour protection, irregardless of the I-5 issue. Back in April, I did testify before the Judiciary Committee on this, at that time, Senate Bill 295. During the meeting, another issue was raised on whether or not the Coburg Police was routing citations through its municipal court for violations occurring outside its city limits. There's two separate issues here. One is, do we patrol outside the city limits of Coburg? The answer is yes. Do we cite violations that occur outside the city of Coburg? Yes. Are those citations routed through Coburg Municipal Court? No. Those citations are routed through Central Lane Justice Court in Springfield for violations, and other matters go through Lane County Circuit Court. I researched this issue with our city administrator, our court administrator. We did locate a very small number of citations that had been heard by the Coburg Municipal Court that should have been routed through Central Lane Justice Court. All of those citations were subsequently dismissed. These instances are being contributed to officer error. There's no effort to circumvent the law. And ironically, all of these citations that were erroneously cited into our court, none of them occurred on I-5. Many people continue to ask why I would choose to do this job at a time when that Coburg is finding itself in. And the point is, I love my town. I live there. I raise my family there. I mean, we're not doing anything wrong. And if I can be a part of the solution, I'm more than happy to do the job. I cannot speak to the methods or motives of my predecessor, the former police chief. I can only speak to my own, and those are to have a police department that operates in full disclosure and transparency, and to have a police department that is reflective of who we are and that small town Oregon. We're working very hard, but we just cannot right this ship overnight. It took several years to get us here. On a personal note, aside from being an employee of the city of Coburg, I find this bill mean-spirited. It's punitive in nature. And I'm still, part of me understands Senator Posansky's issue. But part of me is wondering why there's an attempt to punish. We're not a foreign land that has somehow wronged the state of Oregon and now must be sanctioned for it. As the mayor said, passage of the Senate bill would cripple the city of Coburg at a time when we're just trying to pick up the pieces and move forward. There's still changes that need to be done. There's still things we're looking at to do better. I sincerely urge Madam Chair and committee to vote no on Senate Bill 1047. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, Officer Bosley. Next up, Mr. Landrum.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, I'm here only to answer questions.
You're the certified smart guy.
Yep, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Before you leave, though, I think we have some questions, starting at the far right. Senator Shields.
Thank you for coming and testifying today. I appreciate it. Chief, when you were an officer, do you feel that you wrote any tickets on I-5 that were not justified?
Absolutely not. I feel that some part of this issue is being spun into an ethical issue. My personal ethics and integrity would dictate if we were breaking the law or being unethical, I wouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. I just simply wouldn't do it.
You said that you guys never write tickets. You give warnings, but you never write tickets unless it's over 80 mile an hour?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that's correct.
And let's clarify, the speed limit is 65 in that section of road that goes through Colburn?
Correct.
I-5?
Correct.
Just for the record, ma'am, I've only been stopped once in the state of Oregon on I-5 or any other road, and I was only doing 77.
Great, Senator Shields.
I'm just putting that in perspective. The mayor was very honest a few seconds ago and said she'd been stopped twice.
In my youth, I should point out.
I was much younger myself. But, you know, the point is, the speed limit's 65.
Basic rule.
You know, and this is over 80 mile an hour, these tickets. Okay.
Senator, any more questions, Senator Shields?
No.
Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The, to say the least, you got a public relations problem here. That's the least you can say about this. In perspective, there's been a couple of Eastern Oregon cities that have engaged in aggressive enforcement. And they, too, have essentially come to the attention of the state legislature because the city of Cobourg is a subdivision of the state government. Your charter comes from state government. To a certain extent, the actions of the city reflect on the legislature. And people have come to this body to get a grievance addressed that needs to be addressed. But I'm very sensitive to what the chief said. I don't think you should have let him be your acting chief. You should let him be your chief.
We're looking forward to doing that in the future, sir.
I don't think the officers that are engaged in exercising or carrying out the city's policy are responsible. I think they are directed to do that through the city council and through the mayor's office and through the chief's offices. So I'm not going to hold them responsible. But you can't... it's literally hundreds and hundreds of people who've been ticketed in that section of I-5 would agree you're running a speed trap there. And even though I understand that this good senator's comments about, gee, the limit's 65, that's basic rule. And there are certain circumstances where people set differing policies. You don't ticket below 79 and a half. Other people set a different policy. So motorists on Interstate 5 know that they're coming into an urban area where the speed limit is reduced. You get that stretch just north of Eugene, and it goes from 65 to a 55, I believe. The real issue is the percentage of city income that is derived off of traffic tickets. It was so significant that the Oregon State Police the superintendent of the state police has actually changed state policy by executive order, his order, to OSP outposts, that his officers will not participate in writing or citing into jurisdictions that have a revenue sharing agreement with their municipalities. And the reason that he's done that is because of the public relations nightmare that this is creating with the motoring public. People absolutely cannot believe that that when they're stopped, it isn't about public safety. And I believe that there has been created the apprehension in people's minds that when they're stopped on the Interstate 5 in Cobourg, it isn't about public safety. It's about public revenue. So I think that's the problem that you're up against. I completely understand Senator Prozanski's effort to try to deal with this issue. He's taken 3 years of interaction with the city of Coburg to try to deal with this issue. I understand that you can't turn a battleship overnight, that you created an over-reliance on an income stream, and that now to make those contractions is very difficult. But that doesn't really change the crux of this issue, which is you can't run law enforcement as a revenue producer for your city. It just isn't that way. You just can't do that. So the question is, how quickly can you extract yourself from this over-reliance? And with the senator's bill, it would be in the immediate future. And I understand that will create even more dislocations. I guess I'm trying to figure out, if you've reduced your reliance to something like 33 or 34%.
It's 20-something.
25%. And other cities are around 15.
We're working toward that direction.
I can see their trajectory because, it went up to almost half and now it's coming back down. But the question is, at least the damage to credibility is done. There's no question in my mind that some of the law enforcement that's happened on Interstate 5 has resulted in interdiction of drug shipments and the removal of dangerous citizens on that road. And I think those are the city of Coburg's to be commended for that kind of enforcement. But I hope you can see that when Oregonians see the kind of reliance on the income, they conclude that you are operating a speed trap, and so did the editorial board of the Oregonian conclude that. So I think do most citizens conclude that. So, what's your argument to tell the citizens of Oregon, first of all, do you admit you were running a speed trap and now you're not going to do it? I mean, I don't need a mea culpa. I don't need an admission. I don't want one. I guess what I'm wanting to hear from you is, if you think this bill is unnecessary and you know the date that it goes into effect, does it have an emergency clause?
Yes, it does.
That 90 days out? No, January 1st. Is that?
Yeah. It has an emergency clause that will go in effect July 1st.
Okay, so tell me what happens. Well, theoretically, it goes into effect July 1st.
Yes.
So the question is, what are you doing? What could you do to assure the senator that this practice is going to be normed before that period of time?
Well, July 1, I think, is just extremely hardship. But I think if you look at the last 6 months, the changes that we have made for a small city, and see that the trajectory going down, I think if you would give us a year, I mean, we've become regulars visiting here. If next year we come back and have to visit again,
you'll be all alone in here because we only meet every other year.
Well, 2 years.
But you're welcome to come.
But, Senator, I guess I would respond to that and say that we are definitely making changes. We just feel like we would like to see the Senate work with us and not actually hurt the good people that are trying to make some very positive changes by this.
When did, Madam Chairman,
Sure.
The change of administration occur?
I became mayor in January of 2004 and have worked very hard. We had to dismiss our city reporter that was part of this issue. In September of last year, last December 10th, we entered into a separation agreement with the previous city administrator. So it's really been less than 6 months that we've actually been able to do the things that we've had to do. And in that six-month time, all the changes that I've told you we have taken place. So I think another year will be enough time. We have also investigated other ways that we can have many legs on our stool of our revenue. We realize that this is not the best way to build a city.
Antique tax, for instance.
Antique tax would be great. A business tax. We have several motor coach manufacturing plants. But this all takes time. I can't stress to you enough, we are doing everything that we can. We work very hard. We continue to work very hard. But it's very demoralizing to be to have people not realize what we are trying to do and to exacerbate our problem by this.
Sure, Senator Ferriol.
What would you ask or what would you suggest that Senator Prozanski say to the next 200 people that are sighted on Interstate 5 within the city limits of Coburg about the speed trap issue?
I'm sorry?
What would you tell Senator Prozanski to say to his constituents, the next 200 of those people that receive tickets on Interstate 5 in Coburg. What should he tell those people?
Well, you know, we've talked, or I haven't personally, except briefly, but we've had several of our staff people talk to Senator Pazanski and find out exactly how it is we can work together. We're still willing to have a conversation with him on what he would like to see done, but it hasn't really resulted in any fruition.
I think Senator Pazanski commutes to Eugene on Interstate 5.
I'm certain that he does.
Have a conversation with him on the that'd be a fun one.
We're willing to have a conversation. We just...
Mayor Volta, I think this is a new issue for me. I don't honestly remember voting on the Coburg bill in the 03 session. I probably did. I just frankly don't remember. I think what I'm struggling with is that the legislature passed a bill the last session, you know, in 03, that I think sent a pretty clear message that this was not okay. And I appreciate the fact that you've had a change in administration, et cetera, but I think part of it is a sort of a timing, you know, what kind of guarantees can we give to Senator Morissette, and I assume his constituents that use I-5, Senator Pazanski, that, you know, this is not going to be a problem, you know. And the only guarantee we have is that to pass a bill. And that's, I know, pretty heavy-handed, but, so, I don't know.
Did you want to speak to that?
Yes. Madam Chair, committee members. When this first became an issue in 2001, 2002, up until our former chief's departure, it was not uncommon to see a Coburg police officer on that stretch of freeway every day, 7 days a week. Due to the cutbacks and reductions that I've made, and my personal stance on it, that's been reduced to where, for instance, this week, our traffic enforcement officer worked Monday, and he will not be back until Saturday morning. This, we're not talking, this is not an everyday, all-day occurrence that's occurring.
All right. Thank you, Chief Bosley. Any other questions, Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Just a comment. First, I was kind of surprised, okay, the guy going 118 miles an hour, you let him go because you can't catch him. Right now we only have three state police patrolling the entire stretch of I-5. I think that guy got away. Seems to me the lesson in Coburg is don't go 82 miles an hour because you'll be caught. Go 120 and you won't be caught. But that's just a comment. And second of all, I want to say I don't think
that commentary on the funding that the legislature gives to the Oregon State Police, Senator Ringo.
Yes, it is indeed. Second is, I don't think this bill is meant as a personal rebuke to any of you, and certainly not to the police officers of Coburg. But it's rather intended to address a problem, and it shouldn't be taken personally. I'd like to know a little bit more about the annexation that occurred. According to the Oregonian editorial, or Register Guard editorial, the stretch of I-5 was annexed. When did that occur?
I can speak to that really briefly.
Okay.
It did happen prior to my becoming mayor, but I was a city councilor at that time, and I did go to attend a Lane County hearing, as well as Boundary Commission did accept that. The businesses directly across the I-5 freeway, and you're probably familiar with Coburg, did request to come into the city for law enforcement purposes, and there's a hotel there and a large RV park, and also there's some adjacent land that has been identified as a site for future reservoir for our water system.
So before that annexation, the Coburg city limits did not include any stretch of I-5. After that annexation, you did. And
it crossed I-5.
And you included some commercial properties on the other side of I-5.
That requested to come in, and this did pass Lane County and Boundary Commission.
I see. So that annexation did not occur for the purposes of
in my
facilitating
view, it did
a
not.
Speed trap.
Some people feel that it did, but, sir, my view is that it did not.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. We
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate you being here.
Thank
and you. Well, you weren't so much affected by the time, but, again, I appreciate your... Okay.
You.
Mr. Schuessler and Senator Bill Morissette. Did I get your last name right?
Don Schuessler, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Anything you wish to add in terms of the bill?
Chair Brown, members of the committee.
Oh, yes, and we need you to put the mic in front of your face. Thank you.
My name's Don Schessler. I'm the city council president for Coburg, and I'm also acting as their city administrator now, since we don't have one. I've been doing this for a couple of weeks. We, as you've heard already, the city has taken drastic steps to reduce our dependence on fines as a source of revenue. We've reduced employees in police, public works, court, and have severely cut operating expenses. We're in a program to regain our financial stability and find new revenue sources. As you know, this takes time. It isn't going to happen overnight. Senate Bill 1074 is punitive toward the city, its employees, the people who live there, and the 3,000 people a day that commute to Coburg to work. It will severely hamper our ability to provide services and regain our financial stability as we work to adjust our operating expenses and live within our means. The council is taking a lot more responsibility in the operation of the city. We don't want to be dependent upon fines as a major source of revenue. And that, as you've heard already, it's being drastically reduced. But it takes time to reduce this. So this bill, again, would severely reduce our ability to provide service when a time when we're trying to regain our financial stability and make Coburg a better place. So I just would urge you to vote no on 1074.
Thank you. Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, representing Coburg, among other jurisdictions. Senator Ferrioli well knows Coburg is a hub of industrial development. The RV industry has moved into Coburg. There are a number of activities. Log trucks go down the main street in Coburg. That was part of the reason for the original speed trap, so to speak, to slow the log trucks down coming around that corner going through. I do believe that they have made a tremendous good faith effort to turn it around, and I did testify the last time about this bill. I wanted to testify last this time instead of first to hear the changes that they have made, and I'm impressed. It is interesting that they couldn't stop that car going 112 miles an hour. I don't know if you read the article about the poker run from Seattle to Las Vegas. There were cars that were doing 120 miles an hour. Eight of them were stopped, I believe, in the state of Washington. They caught them. They stopped them. These were people who could afford a $200,000 car, 400 horsepower. We don't have coverage on I-5, unfortunately. And that's our fault because we don't provide the money. I've always been kind of proud of Coburg for the coverage, at least, that they have. And I've heard anecdotal evidence of drug busts that have been stopped from 2 to 4 in the morning and rather large confiscations from those drug busts. I think Coburg, in spite of the bad press, has been doing a public service. I'm not defending what they were doing. I think that it's always questionable when the revenue from the traffic stops go directly to fund city services, and I agree that that's not the way to do things. But I think that they have done in many ways a public service by letting people know that there's at least one place on I-5 where people have to be careful. It's interesting that the speed limit of those issued tickets, I didn't read the Karen McGowan article, but that's impressive that it was up into the 79, 80 miles an hour. The only other thing I can think of in terms of you know, how can you complain about getting a ticket if you're breaking the law? Now, none of us like
there's
that.
There's sort of a problem with that, isn't
it? Yeah, it is a problem. So if you're breaking the law, you're going to get a ticket. Now, you break the law when you go over 65 miles an hour on I-5. That is not a, there's not, that's not a discretionary zone. You can drive through John, into John Day at maybe 80 miles an hour if the road, no, you can't do that in John Day either.
But he can drive from
Burns to Bend.
To
yeah. But anyway, it. I'm not here to defend the past action of Coburg. I'm here to simply say that I think that they have made a good faith effort, and I would not want to see a penalty put in place at this time that would prevent them from making it through this time of crisis. Now, I don't know if Senator Pozanski would be willing to amend the bill to give a grace period before it went into effect, which I think would be fair. Otherwise, I would ask you to just let it sit and rest for a while.
Senator Morissette, a couple questions. I shouldn't assume anything. Did you vote for the Coburg bill in 2003?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't remember that. I don't even remember if I voted for the school safety zone bill.
I did, and that
I know.
Was a really
I think
bad
we it surprised that. A lot of us because there are bills that we obviously missed. I must have missed this one.
Okay, all right. So it wasn't a huge issue for you in 2003. Have you and Senator Pozanski sat down and talked about this issue at all?
Not really. I did speak against it in the last session, or the last when it was in the other committee, but I haven't. We haven't discussed this issue in detail. I would be very happy to discuss this with them at this
all
point.
Right. And then the other issue is the one I tried to raise with the mayor and the chief, and that is, you know, we're not going to be in session for another 2 years. This is simply not acceptable. For this pattern to continue, and I appreciate it, the fact that they've told us that's not the plan, and they're going to do everything they can, and you know, let's have, you know, I'm just trying to think of some wild eye scenarios, but you know, what happens if it just doesn't happen?
Okay. May I respond?
Sure.
Well, I think that there might be ways of drafting a bill that would that would not take effect immediately and would have some punitive parts to the bill that would encourage the city to meet their goal. I think a bill could be drafted that would do that.
Senator Shields?
Are you suggesting something like amending a bill in such a way that there'd be some trigger mechanisms in it?
Yes, I am, that there'd be some trigger mechanisms, giving time for them to recover some of the costs that they need to recover to keep their city running and keep it safe, and then to have some trigger mechanisms in that would kick in.
Okay. All right, any more questions? Senator Ferriola.
Thank you. This is for Mr. Schistler.
Okay.
It seems that there seems to be a ready willingness to admit that over-reliance on fines is part of the city's problem, but it seems that we've been here before. What was the response by the city of Coburg when the bill passed in 2003 to curb this behavior? And how did the city misinterpret the unmistakable message that this behavior wasn't to be tolerated? And Madam Mayor,
sure.
If you'd like to come forward.
Yeah. It's Volta. Is it Volta?
Volta.
Volta. Come on up.
Yeah, don't run away, Bill.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I need you by me. I'd like to quickly respond to that, Madam Chair. In 2003, we still had the prior administration in place. That's really why it wasn't addressed. It was not really the pieces that are in place now. It's different leadership, different regime, different attitude.
But when the legislature passed, I see what you're saying.
Right.
Under the okay,
right.
Prior,
you just ignored the law, Madam Chair.
Correct. Yes. Is that fair to say?
I'd say it's a new day in Coburg.
Okay. All right.
Well put, Madam.
Pardon me?
Well put, Madam Mayor.
Thank you.
A further question, Madam Chair?
Sure, Senator Ferriola.
I do not see that Senator Pozanski is the problem here. but I do wonder how much dialogue there's been between the mayor and Senator Prezansky. Or the city administrator.
I have been willing to speak with Senator Prezansky. I know that different people on behalf of the city have spoken with him several times. I'm still willing to sit and speak with him. I don't want this to be a personal issue between the senator and myself or the senator and the city. I do know that the prior mayor attempted to have a conversation, and I want to make sure, my heart is to see that Coburg goes forward, that Coburg is able to do the best that it can as a little city that can, in a good way and in a meaningful way. I'm willing to sit down with Senator Prezansky at any time. I think the issues that you raised about giving some time, but in the meantime, I think to have this bill go in with an emergency clause would make meeting with him very difficult.
Sarah Ferrielli.
Is the city currently in compliance with the 2003 law?
Yes, it is.
I think we have a difference of opinion.
I think that we do. Are you talking about the law, the citations that have been written in the different courts? At the prior hearing, we presented evidence to show that they had indeed been legal.
Okay, I don't think anybody's suggesting that citations are not legal. What I'm asking you is, are you in compliance as a city with the law that the legislature passed in 2003 relative to this issue? Yes, sir.
Senator, I can say in the law was passed in 2003. In 2004, 65% of the citations that were issued by Coburg went to the Central Lane Justice Court.
So you feel you're in compliance?
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, I'm hoping there's a solution that we can bring to this problem that obviates the necessity for another law.
Right.
Because, you know, it makes us look ridiculous when we pass a law and the cities ignore us.
It really does.
Madam Chair.
And I want to tell you something. You provided proof that it isn't just Portland bashing that we do in the legislature, because other cities get in the crosshairs once in a while, too.
Yeah, we support local control as long as we like what the local folks are doing.
Exactly.
So.
Madam Chair,
I just wanted to point out that, you know, you're looking for this other mechanism to add the other legs to the stool. Why don't we just hire police officers on commission basis and just turn them loose?
Okay.
Hey,
Sarah Morissette, did you wish to add something?
That's kind of what we're doing here.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't completely answer the question because I didn't think of the time, but I did have one conversation with Senator Prezansky after the last hearing in the Judiciary Committee. I was told by the Judiciary Chair that she would not move that bill unless Senator Prezansky had an amendment that I agreed with, and so he did give me, we had one discussion, and I felt that he hadn't moved. He explained what he was trying to do, but I didn't see that as a movement, and that was the last discussion we had about that. Senator Prezansky and I worked together on a lot of issues, and this just hasn't come up since that time.
Okay.
Sarah Ferrier.
I just wanted to comment on the panel that we had here today. I appreciate the acting chief's contact. We've been corresponding by email. I appreciate the fact that when everything's going swell, it's easy to be a city councilor or a mayor. It's only when things get thin that it's tough. And I really appreciate the fact that we have people willing to serve. I believe that there's a solution that we can find to the problem. I'm glad that you're willing to devote yourself to public service and law enforcement. I think that's a very noble and laudable cause, and I'm hoping we can come to a solution that eliminates what's clearly a perception by the public that Coburg is operating, if not outside the law, certainly in a way that is predatory in terms of revenue. So I'm hoping you can fix it.
May I?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. When I became mayor of Springfield or on the council in 1987, I believe there were a number of recalls in the city of Coburg, both of the councilor and of the mayor. And I think the city of Coburg is, I don't know if it's a typical small town, but when things like that get started, it makes it very difficult. And I particularly admire the current administration, the councilors, the city manager, the chief of police, the mayor, because they are working very, very hard in a very difficult climate. Because no matter what you do, and you know, there's always going to be part of your constituency in that city that's going to not agree with you. But they are, I think, going out on a limb and doing, putting themselves at risk and trying to do the right thing.
Madam Chair, for the record, just to put things in perspective, I appreciate the idea that you believe you need 24-hour police protection in Coburg. I understand that community. I lived in Lane County for 20 years. I now represent a district of 34,000 square miles that have more municipalities than any other district in Oregon. 12 counties. Not one of those jurisdictions, not one of them, has 24-hour police protection. So everybody's up against the same kind of problems. You just, the solutions that you find are just going to have to go further.
I could make some comment about the extent of law enforcement we have in Portland, but I will not. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
we really
you.
Appreciate you being here. Senator Prozanski, you want to come up and make some comments?
You need law enforcement.
Yeah, well, we've got Multnomah County Sheriff, we've got Portland Police, we've got Oregon State Police. We're well taken care of.
Thanks for using the left chair.
You guys met Senator Prozanski? That's Senator Morsak.
Yeah, we know each other. Actually, we work pretty well together. Again, for the record, Floyd Prozanski, State Senator, District 4. I want to just respond to some of the statements that were made and maybe try to answer some of the questions the panel put forward. First of all, I want to make it very clear. This issue came to my attention back in 2001, 2002 from the state police. Their concern as to what they were seeing, what was going on at that time. The concerns that I have today are these, and they didn't say this, and I'm not sure why they didn't. Jamin Kent, who was their acting city manager, he and I have talked in great detail since the session began. I told him I was going to be bringing this bill forward, told him why I was bringing it forward. He and I met, and he asked for it to have a grace period up until the beginning of this new fiscal year, which will be July 1. And I assured him that whatever we did, whatever I brought forward, I would make that happen. And here's the issue. They got $300,000 worth of debt. They still want to use this system. If they were actually doing what they say they're doing inside the jurisdiction and enforcing the law only inside the jurisdiction, I would be fine with that. But I don't believe they are. Based on what I've seen, where their officers are set up, it's outside of the jurisdiction. I've checked with the Lane Central Justice Court. They are not receiving citations where the officers are operating their radar or the laser, they would have to be putting those into a different court. That's my concern. I think they're still continuing the practice because the part that they actually had annexed is a very flat, open area where the officers are basically out in the open. And the other place where they've been setting up, where I've been seeing them, is on the south end, outside of the jurisdiction, right where at the McKenzie Bridge, where you come over where Eggy Service Road is. And the jurisdiction, for the record, that they've annexed is from the Van Dyne exit, which is the main Coburg exit, south, to just north of the Reed's Service Road. So between the two overpasses is their area. Now, I took in consideration, based on what they stated in the Judiciary Committee, to reduce the penalty time from 2 years to 1 year, thinking that that would show some type of trade-off that they are actually trying, and maybe they shouldn't be prohibited from getting back into using that as other cities. The reality is the majority of cities, their reliance on this revenue is somewhere between 2 and 6%. There are some that are up 8 and 10. There's a few that are up 15. You asked the question.
That's along the I-5 corridor?
Yes.
Okay.
You asked the question, Senator Farioli, as to what did they do through this transition after the law was passed. If you look at the article that I provided to the committee from Brian Denson, it's a 5-page article off the OregonLive.com. They state in there that 3,913 citations were issued in the last 6 months of 2003. Now, we adjourned in August. I had a conversation with the chief of police, also the former mayor, Mike Dean, and they asked, Mike Dean asked me, he says, when is your law going into effect? Mm-hmm. Well, it's not scheduled to go into effect until
January 1. His statement to me was, oh, good, we hope to have the property annexed and we'll have that territory by then. And then basically, I think it speaks for itself, what they basically did was load it up. They were under the impression that they had the authority to use their municipal court, which they did not, even under the old law. This was just basically clarifying, and we restructured it so there could be no difference of opinion exactly what the prohibition was. But they acted in violation of that prohibition. They had a 10-month period from the time that we shut down the session before there was annexation. The annexation occurred on November 3rd of last year. So they have not had authority over any part of I-5 until November of 3rd of this last year.
And they continue to issue tickets.
And they continue to issue tickets.
All right. So, Senator Prezansky, how do you respond to the fact that there's a new sheriff in town? I mean, literally a new administration.
Well, I would say two things. Number one, that new administration has been there longer than what they're wanting to take credit for, as to just being 6 months. And this was something that we'd worked with, and as the good mayor said, she was part of the city council when this was happening. Yes, I agree. There's been some problems. One of the other problems is that the city manager at the time that they're talking about is Mike Hudson. The chief of police at the time was Mike Hudson. So you had one person serving in two capacities, which I have to tell you is a pretty big conflict, to basically have someone trying to raise revenue and at the same time take care of the public safety part. That's where they ran their trouble. And the reason he was city manager is because the city council hired him. So with all due respect to the city, I work on principles. I believe that they are in violation and still continue to be in violation. Do you want to give them another 6 months to do so? So be it. You know, if this is what the wisdom and the judgment of this committee, and you want this to have a regular date of enactment, being January 1 of next year, which will be 2006, that would give them another 6 months to basically take care of getting their books in order. They'll hopefully will extinguish the $300,000 debt they have. And then I'm going to ask you to have at least a 1 year, if not at that point an 18-month moratorium on them receiving any fines off of that. Because I don't think until you actually break them loose from that, where they're not dependent on any of that money from I-5, will they actually make that complete transition. Then they can come back in, and we have put in 10%, which I think is fair and more than reasonable compared to what other cities have done, and they could in that time do as other cities have done. There's nothing wrong with them using it.
Okay. I'm going to stop you. Okay. I appreciate all of you being here. We're not going to move this bill today. I need to have conversations with Senator Prezansky and Senator Morissette, and we'll go from there. Thank you all very much. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Traveling in within the speed limit to join us. Close the public hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing on the executive appointment of Stephen Piper to the Public Safety Standards and Training Board. Mr. Piper, would you come on forward? And again, my apologies for keeping you waiting.
I have a question for Mr. Piper, whether or not he sees a training opportunity.
You have a very good sense of what we deal with at the legislature.
Vice Chair Ferrioli and Senator Shields.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you'd like to serve on this particular board?
My name is Steve Piper. I'm a police officer with the Gresham Police Department up in that metropolitan area up there. And I've been a police officer for 13 years with Gresham Police Department. I've served as a police officer, training officer, and currently assigned as the training coordinator for the department. I also serve as an instructor in first aid, CPR, firearms, hazmat, bloodborne pathogens, and I'm the reserve officer, unit advisor, as well as a member of the Gresham Police Honor Guard.
Okay.
I also serve as the second vice president of the Oregon Peace Officers Association.
And I understand that you're filling a specific statutory requirement on the board, but could you tell us why you want to put your heart and soul into serving on the BPSST?
Well, as you can see, I've taken a lot of pride and passion in doing a lot of jobs on the Gresham Police Department. And when I came to the Oregon Peace Officers Association, I liked the mission statement that the department had, or the organization had, and I felt I could be a part of that organization. I started as an alternate e-board member, then an e-board member, treasurer, and now currently the second vice president. And I believe serving in a capacity, stepping up and filling the responsibilities to give an ethical and professional quality to law enforcement is my goal.
Questions?
No, thank you. Appreciate
what you
said.
Thank you.
Thanks. Could you talk? One of my concerns about this particular board is that because of the statutory criteria, there are frankly a number of men on the board, and my guess is a number of white men. Could you talk to me about any experiences you've had in terms of multicultural training within your law enforcement agency, and can you bring any of those experiences to the board?
I believe I can. You might know that my chief is a female, and I have a very good rapport with Chief Peluso. She's a wonderful person.
Character, isn't she?
She is a very vibrant and powerful person. In my capacity as training coordinator, I brought in cultural diversity training as well as sexual harassment training into the department. And filling it's not always the most popular training with the law enforcement staff, but I know it's a requirement. I know it's important for police officers to get this training as frequently as we can.
And what about, I'm assuming in your work in Gresham that you're dealing with the changing face of Gresham. I assume the Latino population is expanding greatly.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about those experiences and what you see the force doing to kind of respond to the needs of that particular community?
As I stated, we have cultural diversity training, and we continue to promote that cultural diversity training. There's a number of handouts that we have, orders on that, and we've also sent out training orders on the matricular consular, on the identification card for Mexican nationals, as well as to educate the officers and staff on the cards that they will be seeing.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Piper?
Hi.
Sarah Shields.
I get to know Gresham pretty good over the last 8 years of representing the district just to the west, represent East Portland. And I think Gresham Police do a really good job.
Well, thank you.
Kind of building on the chair's questions, are you comfortable maybe calling on the expertise of your police chief or other women or minorities when you get into some arenas on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, even though they're maybe not there, recognizing that, you know, if you don't have enough minorities, maybe you need to talk to some, and maybe you need to consult with your own chief and stuff like that. How would that feel to you?
Oh, it would feel fine. And as a matter of fact, our chief has tried to push the hiring towards more minority officers. We've had our recruiting staffs go to various Hispanic cultural events, dealing with the Latino culture in Gresham, and specifically going there with our community safety personnel and trying to open up pathways of communication with the Latino community. So I think our chief has been very proactive in reaching out to the community, reaching out to women, and bringing them into the Gresham Police Department.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Ethereal? Looks like you passed in muster, at least in terms of questioning. We really appreciate you coming down today. We're asking people to come down so we have a better sense of the breadth and the depth of experiences of Oregonians that are serving on our boards and commissions, and also to have a better understanding of how the legislative process works. So we figure it's a twofer. So.
It was quite interesting.
I'm sure it was. Thank you, Mr. Piper. I'm going to open a quick public hearing and see if we can get a hold of Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson. While I'm doing that, I'm going to open public hearings on the other folks in the room. Hi, this is Senator Kate Brown calling. Is Dr. Knight Richardson still available?
Yes, just one moment.
Thanks. Find out if anybody is here to testify on the Commission for the Blind, the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission, or the Commission for Women. Seeing none, we'll close those public hearings.
Don't you think if we had music playing the Capitol all the time that it would be a happier place?
No. We could just get some oxygen piped in to the Senate chamber and have the lead removed from the water.
You think we need more oxygen in the chamber? I was thinking we need less.
Well, we used it all up this morning.
Chairman Brown?
Yes.
Hi, this is Dr. Knight Richardson.
Hi. Welcome, and I'm sorry we didn't get a hold of you sooner. We've just had a crazy day at the Capitol. And I wanted to send my Senator Atkinson's regards. He's not here this afternoon, but he says you walk on water. So just so you know.
I think we have a mutual admiration.
In front of me, I've got Senator Frank Shields and Senator Farioli and myself. Just want to say we really appreciate your willingness to serve on the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Could you just tell us, for the record, just a little bit about yourself and why your interest on this particular board?
Certainly, and let me first thank you all for the honor of being able to speak with you and be considered by you for this board. I am a board-certified psychiatrist who in his other life was an international banker. I tell you, it makes more sense being a psychiatrist.
Than a banker?
I was an international banker before I was a psychiatrist. So I bring a peculiar set of administrative skills into the field, and thus, as you see in my resume, I have been in a number of administrative posts, and largely in the public sector of psychiatry. So I have an abiding interest in this medical specialty and its interface with the public, where many of our patients end up because the diseases really doesn't allow them in the severe instances to work and contribute to their own economic well-being. So they end up being in the public system. So I have worked in that system with people, patients, since I graduated in 1988 from my residency. I have I've been the CEO of a public psychiatry. I was psychiatry hospital in Alaska. I was CEO of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute and chief psychiatrist for that state, where I helped the governor strategize about the mental health system and the inpatient as well as the outpatient aspects of that. As a chief psychiatrist and CEO of the hospital, I also had a forensic unit and did a lot of work with the forensic patients until we moved that unit out of the hospital. I then left Alaska and was in Texas, where I was a gubernatorial appointee for alcohol and substance abuse and an advisor to the mental health system there and to Governor Bush. I wanted to move to the Northwest, came back here and worked inpatient as the medical director for Legacy Health System, and have been active in a number of areas here in the state, and served on the President's New Freedom Commission, where we looked at the entire mental health system of the United States and made recommendations to the President, and in that included a committee basically the criminal justice system and interface with psychiatry. I chaired cultural competence and co-chaired rural and the interface of family medicine and psychiatry. I currently am an associate professor at the university here, where I am director of the Public Psychiatry Training Program. I'm on the board of trustees for the OHSU Foundation and on the audit committee of that body. I remain a senior policy advisor in Washington, advising the National Institutes of Mental Health on a number of issues, and was, until he left, a senior policy advisor to Tommy Thompson, and who had a real appreciation for the fact that since 1963, when it was the beginning of deinstitutionalization and really the failure of the nation to commit to community mental health as the chief avenue for treatment. There has been a large influx of people into the criminal justice system, and I've worked with the U.S. Justice Department and also talking about these issues and trying to figure out the best solutions to this population of people who found themselves also in the criminal justice system. So that's a summary of, and I probably left out some things, but what I feel
I think we got the general gist of right. your the depth of your experience and your talent. A couple quick questions, and this is from me. In my opinion, we have a system that I would call unconstitutional. We have youths in our juvenile justice system that either are severely mentally ill or are developmentally disabled, and they are either being held in our Oregon Youth Authority behind lock and key, or they're under a pretty loose structure of DHS. In trying to assess that system, we have created a bill that would create essentially a juvenile psychiatric security review board, basically giving the adult psychiatric security review board the authority to place these youth in appropriate settings. Any thoughts? Because right now we have an Oregon State Hospital that is not adequate for youth. We've got some of these young people at the Oregon Youth Authority behind lock and key, and some of them, frankly, fairly dangerous, living in our neighborhoods. Any thoughts?
Let me first ask you, Chair, are you saying that this child psychiatric or youth psychiatric security review board would be there as a basically as the legal triage body to determine after adjudication where these young people would receive their treatment and for how long?
Yes. Essentially, they would be in the dispositional phase.
Right, right. Well, my thought is, I'm not sure why that wouldn't work. I too am disturbed by the incarceration of children for, especially the developmentally delayed, and you have to test for their competence and all that. But it is not curative, and I think the system is more helter skelter than it need be. So I would have to look at the details of that, not fully understanding from your description how that might work. But it seems to me a sound idea to look into.
Thank you. Other questions from the panel? Senator Farrioli?
Madam Chairman, I don't have any questions about the qualifications of the nominee other than just to ask a question or make an observation. I think it's very interesting that in discussing the qualifications of the applicant for the Psychiatric Security Review Board, your first comment was that we've had a crazy day at the Capitol. And I just wondered if Dr. Knight Richards can tell me, what did she really mean by that?
Well, I will tell you, Senator, that I almost quipped. I've had a crazy day here, too.
Okay.
And I didn't see patients today.
That makes us all feel better.
Come on down.
Senator Shields, any comments?
No.
Dr. Knight Richardson, excuse me, we just really appreciate your willingness to serve on the Oregon Psychiatric Security Review Board. We're waiting a week on all of these appointments. We anticipate they'll move to work session. If there's any issues in terms of your ability to get votes on the committee or the Senate floor, we'll let Nancy Gosteran know, but I can't imagine, given your broad support in both caucuses, that it's going to be an issue.
Well, thank you very much. I'm humbled by this this opportunity, and I can only assure you that I will give it my best if you should choose.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
You're very welcome, Senators. Good night.
Good night.
Now, Madam Chairman, I think you're to be commended, having heard that the applicant once was affiliated with the Florida Bush administration, not to have asked for any opinions about the chief executive.
No, of course not.
Besides
Tommy Thompson. I think that's it, you guys. We do have one bill draft, but we can wait for tomorrow. We are meeting tomorrow at 8.
8:30.
Yeah, 8:30.
8:30. We'll wait until tomorrow. Okay, let's go home. We're adjourned. Thank you both.